Hi, listeners. I'm your host, Rebecca Kelly, and welcome back to The Station, a fiction podcast about a girl named Ida who's trapped on board an old space station. If you're new here, this podcast is me reading my novel, The Station, chapter by chapter, and the book is available as an ebook and as a paperback on Amazon. And if you want to keep up to date with my upcoming books, monthly book sale promos, and my most recent book reviews, sign up for my newsletter on my website. All the information will be linked in the show notes right below this episode. Now, let's get back to the story. Ida is working on repairs to the Soyuz spacecraft that will hopefully get the ship in good enough shape to bring her home. Now, she has to perform a series of spacewalks to do this, and so far, they've gone as planned with no issues. Until the last one. So let's dive back into the story. Here are chapters 39, 40, and 41 of The Station. I was using a laser cutter on the aluminum hull of the service module when it happened. An alarm sounded inside the headset of my suit. Hull breach. The alarm made sense, after all. I was breaching the hull of my own station by cutting a big chunk of aluminum off of it. I expected the hull breach alarms, but I didn't expect them to make me so nervous. It also didn't help that I was totally exhausted after the first spacewalk 2 days ago. The first one was a killer on my joints and muscles. I spent the better part of the day after applying cold packs to my body and chewing ibuprofen tablets. I wasn't even given the whole day off. The batteries I removed from the outside of the station are these big, bulky things, and I had to move them into the tiny descent module of the Soyuz. NASA assured me that this was possible, but it was not an easy task. Technically, I could have taken them apart. They're full of a bunch of individual cells, so each bulky container is really more of a battery pack, you could say. But NASA didn't want to risk this because the odds are too great that I'd damage them in the process. Plus, it's easier to wire them into the Soyuz as a whole unit versus a bunch of little cells. The good part is the Soyuz is in microgravity, making it way easier to maneuver the big batteries than it would have been in full gravity. Still, it took me almost 3 hours to get them moved from the airlock and settled in place inside the Soyuz. And by in place, I mean strapped into the two empty seats inside the descent module. The ship has three seats for three astronauts. I plan to occupy the third seat, obviously. I place one battery into each seat and then balance the third on top of those two, strapping everything down with duct tape. It took me another 4 hours to get them wired into the ship, but now they're installed and they seem to be functioning properly, meaning I will have power on my short ride home, which is a good thing. So, the next day, when I was performing the second spacewalk to repair the outer hull of the Soyuz, I was totally exhausted. That's when the suit alarm indicating the hull breach sent my anxiety soaring. Ali sent his team of engineers into the computer system to shut down the alarm, but unfortunately, a hull breach alarm isn't so easily disabled. It's considered a top priority alarm. They eventually got it turned off, but the constant ping in my earpiece gave me the nerves. My hands were shaking and I was sweating like a pig. I kept thinking about how crazy I was for actually going forward with this plan to cut holes in the outer skin of my space station. Fortunately, the rational part of my brain eventually won and started to calm my body down. Even so, it took the better part of 6 hours outside in the void to get enough Kevlar cut from the service module to patch the Soyuz. And the really unfortunate part is, now I have to go back out there. It took much longer than expected to cut out the Kevlar, and I'll have to do a third spacewalk tomorrow to actually patch the Soyuz. I'm back inside now. I left the harvested Kevlar pieces in the airlock, and to tell you the truth, I'm happy they're there. I closed up the hatch immediately to seal them off. I don't like the way they smell. They smell like space. It's a strange, burnt kind of a smell, all raw and smoky. I don't want it permeating the rest of the station. My stay here won't be too much longer, but I'd rather not smell the odor of space while I'm here. It makes me uneasy. I'm going to sleep now. Tomorrow will be, hopefully, my last spacewalk before leaving this place. Third time's a charm, right? Chapter 40. Ali paced the center of the room. His headset light flickered bright green in the dim lighting of the conference room. He was in the middle of a heated discussion with one of the engineers. The engineer in question was in charge of the team overseeing the airlock functions. Ida, on the dark side of the Earth, was pacing in her own way. She was counting backwards from 1,000 inside her spacesuit, just inside the airlock hatch. They had a serious problem. It had taken her a full 6 hours to get the Kevlar fabric that she had harvested from the belly of the service module attached to the outer hull of the Soyuz. The patch was supposed to take no longer than 3 hours, but everyone, including Ale, had underestimated the sturdiness of the Kevlar. It was not only thick, but it was fibrous, and after 18 years in vacuum and extreme temperatures, it had toughened up to the point where it was almost impossible to bend. They knew after the prior day's spacewalk that it would be tough stuff to work with, yet nobody predicted how hard it would be to mold it onto the skin of the Soyuz. Ale mentally kicked himself for not taking that into account, but much to everyone's relief, Ida found a way. Using her wrench set, combined with heat from her blowtorch, she managed to figure out a way to wield the material into the necessary shape to fit the sides of the Soyuz. The key to this installation was that there would be no gap between the Kevlar and the Soyuz. If gaps existed, air would leak in once the ship hit the atmosphere. At such high speeds, the air pockets would cause friction, ripping the blankets from the Soyuz and exposing the capsule to intense heat. After some experimentation, Ida found that she could heat a flat-sided wrench with the blowtorch and create a space iron, as she called it. Nix held the torch, and Ida held the handles at the ends of the longest wrench, measuring 1 meter in length. He was careful to avoid her gloves while they did this. Then she slowly pulled the wrench down the fabric, and the extreme cold of space would flash freeze the unruly fabric into place. Then, once she got the right shape, she welded the seams directly to each other and to the outside of the Soyuz, creating a perfect seal. These additional steps took time, lots of time. Before they knew it, the 6-hour spacewalk time frame came and went. But she had done it, and that meant Ida would be on her way to the surface in just a few short hours, which made everyone working in the makeshift mission control breathe a big sigh of relief. The feeling of relief lasted exactly 6 minutes and 43 seconds, the moment Ida entered the airlock and attempted to close the outer door. The airlock was where she now waited, floating just outside the inner door, counting to herself in an attempt to calm herself down. She had entered the airlock a few minutes earlier, and when she turned to close the hatch, she noticed a slight warping of the metal on the outside of the frame. It wasn't a large area, maybe a few centimeters, but the warped metal was just large enough to catch the corner of her eye. The problem had actually occurred many hours earlier, a few seconds after the airlock depressurization at the beginning of the spacewalk. When she opened the hatch, a silent burst of air popped through the seal, twisting the metal slightly. The Soviets had a similar incident happen once on the Mir space station. An outward opening airlock became warped and refused to close after a spacewalk. Since that time, airlock doors were always designed to open inward. This design used the natural forces of the pressurized atmosphere inside to help push the door into place and tighten the seal. In the case of the Soviet airlock failure, the door had been opened before the lock had fully decompressed. This extra pressure forced the door to open outward in an explosive manner. That explosive decompression, as slight as it may have been, caused the frame of the door to warp, and the astronauts were then stuck outside. Thankfully, they were able to use a different airlock on the Mir to get back inside. Ida's exit from the airlock at the beginning of the spacewalk had a similar problem. Although her airlock door opened inward, a tiny amount of atmosphere had been trapped between the outer hull and the inner hull because of a hairline fracture in the seal. The fracture happened during the depressurization the day before and was caused by the age of the seals. NASA knew that a seal fracture was a possibility, but they considered it a low risk since the airlocks had not been opened or closed for many years. When Ida came back in from her spacewalk the previous day and closed the airlock door, the fracture allowed a tiny amount of air to seep in between the inner seal and outer seal. Then, when she opened the hatch for her third and final spacewalk, the tiny amount of air caused an explosive decompression, shooting the hatch door inward and warping the metal on the outer casing. Ida noticed this, of course. The door shot back with much more force than it had the other 2 times she had opened it. At the time, she examined it and found that nothing looked out of place. NASA cleared her to continue with the spacewalk. After she spent the next 6 hours forcing the aged Kevlar into place, the airlock issues had been all but forgotten. Until now. As Ale spoke hurriedly into the phone, sweat broke out around his collar, causing him to pull at it with rough, harsh tugs. He fought to loosen his tie before finally ripping it from his shirt and tossing it onto an empty chair propped against the wall. "What can we do?" he said to the engineer on the other end of the line, his voice cracking with desperation. "I mean, we had to consider hatch failure a possibility, right?" He paused, listening to the voice on the other end, nodding his head. His face became redder by every passing second. "Yeah, but just because it worked out before didn't mean..." "Yeah, uh-huh," he said, nodding and trying to calm himself. At this point, one of the other engineers in the room approached Ale with a pad of paper in his hand. He gestured toward the notebook and mouthed something to Ale, who glanced at it and nodded, shooing the engineer away with his free hand. There was another airlock that Ida could use, but the problem was that the spare airlock had been struck 6 years earlier by a large piece of debris. Pieces of debris hit the outer hull of the Delta almost daily. Most of them were small and didn't do any harm, other than denting the surface of the hull, but occasionally there had been larger strikes that caused bigger problems. This was one of those. The debris strike did extensive damage to that hatch, causing new to seal it from the inside. They considered it a dead option. Opening it would be done only in case of extreme emergency. But each passing second brought them a second closer to that extreme emergency. Ida's spacesuit was cleared to go for 6 hours, and she was already 32 minutes beyond that time. Her oxygen supply was at a critical level. They figured she had about 20 more minutes. They were running out of time. The airlock was part of the docking module and was made up of two areas, the briefing node and the airlock itself. The briefing node was a small room where they kept the extra spacesuits and where astronauts got ready to do spacewalks. There were three doors, or hatches, included in this design. The innermost hatch led from the docking module into the briefing node. Then there was a hatch between the briefing node and the airlock. Finally, there was the door to the outside, the one that warped during decompression. In case of hatch failure, they could depressurize the briefing node, allowing Ida to enter through the inner hatch instead. But at the moment, the inner hatch stood wide open. They couldn't depressurize the briefing node without depressurizing the entire station. Under normal circumstances, this hatch could be closed by another astronaut inside the station. But with no other astronauts on board, it was a situation they never considered. Ale continued to listen on the other end of the phone. From time to time, he would say something in short, clipped sentences to the engineer, and listen again, letting out exasperated sighs in response. He turned around to see Yuri standing right behind him. So close, it made Ale jump back. Yuri's arms were folded in front of him, and he had a strange look on his face. Ale turned back to the phone and said, "Let me call you back." Yuri cocked his head slightly to one side before saying, "What about the robot?" Chapter 41. "We have a plan. I'm not sure it's a good plan, but it is a plan, so that's good news. Nix will go inside through his special airlock and close up the innermost hatch so that I can enter through the briefing node and bypass the warped door on the airlock. Why can't I go through the robot airlock myself? Well, that would be convenient, wouldn't it? But they didn't design it to fit a person, especially one wearing a bulky spacesuit. It's only big enough for him, and even he has to fold up to get in there. They're discussing the plan right now, down on the surface. I keep counting. 538, 537, 536. I pull up the oxygen reading on the inner faceplate of my helmet. It says I have 16 minutes of oxygen remaining. I squeeze my eyes shut. 535, 534, 533. Will Nix be able to close the inner hatch and depressurize the briefing node? I have to admit, I'm worried about him. He is a robot, after all. I mean, he's meant to perform minor tasks. Depressurizing an airlock is not part of his repertoire of duties, and neither is closing up a complicated hatch door. But it's the only option we've come up with. 532, 531, 530. The low oxygen alarm starts to sound inside my helmet, a slow, steady beep. I let my counting fall into step with the beeping. 529, 528, 527. I open my eyes. We've been on the dark side now for about 20 minutes. The stars out here look so much closer than they do from the inside. I know they aren't, but it feels like I could reach out and grab one of them. I wonder what it would be like to hold a tiny star in my hand. I close my eyes again and try to keep my heart from racing. 526, 525, 524. Ale is on the radio again in my ear. Nix is at the inner hatch, Ale says. I let him know I heard him. I turn around and look in the tiny porthole window in the center of the hatch. Nix's smiling Iron Man face is staring back at me. A laugh escapes my lips. I've probably never been in more danger of dying, but the sight of Nix's ridiculous Iron Man head still makes me laugh. After a moment, I realize he's just sitting there, staring at me. He isn't actually moving to do anything. He still has to close the hatch and depressurize the briefing node. I check the oxygen reading again. 13 minutes. It could be wrong. Maybe that reading is like the expiration date on a dairy product. I've never had a dairy product, but I've read about them. The government makes all dairy producers issue an expiration date for their products. Just because something expires doesn't mean it's bad. The date is a general idea for when it might go bad. Maybe my spacesuit is set to warn me early as a precautionary measure. Maybe there's still 20 minutes or 30 minutes or an hour left of oxygen. Enough time for us to think of something else. I close my eyes again. 523, 522, 521. My radio crackles and I hear Ale say, "Okay, Ida, he's going to close the inner hatch now." I nod in reply. I know he can't see me do this, but my voice isn't working right now. This is the part that worries me the most. If Nix can't get the door closed, I won't be getting in. At least, not through this door. The three airlock hatches are all the same. The door Nix must close is a round aluminum door with pressure seals along the edge. A gearbox sits in the middle of the door, just under the window. It opens and closes the six latches that secure the hatch. There's a big handle on the gearbox, too. If the electrical components of the box don't work, you can manually open the latches by cranking the handle counterclockwise. Then, once it's closed, the briefing node can be pressurized, either by a command from the central computer or by manual valves inside the node. I watch Nix, but he still hasn't done anything. He's just staring at me. I mumble, trying to find the words to tell Ale that Nix isn't moving. But before I can say anything, he moves. He grabs the handhold on the wall to his right and turns himself around so he's facing the door. Then he pulls the inner door closed. I can see the latches click into place as he works the controls to the gearbox. He turns around and puts one of his thumbs up in the air to let me know that all is okay. I release a long sigh of relief and say, "Ale, he's got the door closed. Do you confirm?" A moment later, Ale says, "Yes, we confirm. The door is closed and latched. We're running pressure tests now. Should only be a few more minutes, then we'll have him depressurize the briefing node." I close my eyes again and smile, grateful I'm not facing this situation alone. Grateful that Nix is there and that he has the ability to help me. Grateful that Ale is leading me through this. Ale comes back on the radio and says, "We're going to have Nix depressurize the briefing node now. Stay away from the hatch, just in case." He still sounds very nervous. "Okay," I say. I suppose they want me as far away from the hatch as I can in case the hatches give way and the whole station depressurizes, blowing me and my atmosphere out into space. Frankly, if this happens, there won't be anything left to save me. But I oblige and say, "I'll hook onto the handholds on the starboard side of the outer hatch. Will that work?" "Perfect," he says. "Hold tight." He's working on it now. Within a few seconds of reaching the handholds and hooking on with my tether, the carbon dioxide alarm inside the suit starts to sound too. It's a long, mournful tone, unlike the oxygen alarm's quick beat. It's interesting how different they are. I close my eyes again and resume counting, trying to take my mind off of the suit alarms. 520, 519, 518. When I get down to 500, I decide that I have to say something. Ale, what's going on? Why isn't he through yet?
He's working on it, Ale says in a short, clipped voice.
What's the issue? I bite my lip.
There's no issue, he says, without elaboration.
A few more seconds tick by, and Nyx pops his head out of the airlock. I've never been so happy to see Iron Man in my life.
I'm here. Did you miss me? He says.
Not at all, I say, and a laugh of pure relief escapes me. I unhook my tether from the handholds, and we head into the briefing node together. I turn to close the middle hatch, and the latches click into place without issue. Then I turn the manual valves to start repressurizing the room with atmosphere. Within a few seconds, I feel the rush of the atmosphere filling the room. After several minutes, the rush subsides and finally stops. I don't ask Ale for an update. I'm tired of hearing these alarms buzzing inside my helmet. I reach up and snap the helmet locking mechanism open. There's a hiss as the two atmospheres, the one in my helmet and the one in the airlock, meet for the first time. I breathe in and the air smells good, much better than the air in the spacesuit.
How do you feel, Ida? Nyx asks.
I'm good, Nyx. Feeling great. And it's true. I do feel great. The spacewalks are in my past. My rescue ship is ready to go. In 2 days, I'm going to the surface. I'm going home to meet my future.
Thanks for listening, sci-fi fans. It appears that Ida will finally be on her way to the surface soon. Join me on the next episode where she prepares to say her final goodbyes to the Delta. You don't want to miss it. See you then. Bye.